Now, from Mayo Clinic, it's Medical Edge Weekend, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. Plus, we'll take you beyond the headlines for in-depth discussions of what developments in medicine mean to you. Information you want from specialists who know. Join the conversation by phone, through our blog, or on Twitter by going to radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McCray.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Welcome, everyone, to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, May is Brain Tumor Awareness Month, and that's our topic for today's program. You and some people in our audience may think brain tumors are rare, but I suspect everybody here and everybody who is listening knows somebody who has a brain tumor or who has had one. Brain tumors can strike virtually anyone, men, women, children, at any age. Brain tumors really play no favorites. There are close to 700,000 people in the United States right now who are living with a brain tumor. And every year, about 65,000 new patients are diagnosed with a brain tumor. And about a third of those, I think, are malignant or cancerous. And more than any other tumor in any other part of the body, brain tumors, whether they are benign or cancerous, have, as you might suspect, all sorts of life-altering effects. I mean, after all, the brain controls everything in the rest of our body. So psychological, behavioral, physical, all sorts of problems that brain tumors can cause. And it depends partly on the size of the brain tumor and where it's located in the brain.
Well, today on Medical Edge Radio, we'll meet Mayo Rochester neurosurgeon Dr. Michael Lane. And neuro-oncologist, that's a brain cancer specialist.
Exactly, yep.
Dr. Alex Porter, she is calling in from our sunny Scottsdale, Arizona location, which of course it is not here in Minnesota right now.
And we all wish we were there.
Oh, we do. We're going to talk about the usual symptoms related to brain tumors and explain the difference between a primary and a secondary tumor in the brain. We'll talk about how the diagnosis is made and tell you all about the different ways that doctors treat brain tumors.
Plus, we're going to get two experts' opinion on whether or not cell phones cause cancer.
Okay.
We'll look forward to that. And we'll meet a mother later in the hour, and now an author, Jen O'Hara, who will tell us about how a brain tumor impacted her family.
It's a great story. We look forward to listening to that. But first, the American Heart Association's Twin Cities Heart Walk is just a few hours away from kickoff. The Heart Walk involves thousands of participants from across the state of Minnesota who are gathering at the home of the Minnesota Twins, who are on the road, Target Field. Of course, that's why we can be there.
I'm sure they're glad they're on the road.
I'm sure they are. If healthy hearts are up for discussion, you know that Mayo Clinic will be there with bells on. So we're going to check in with some of our staff who's already on site, joining us now from the Mayo Clinic Department of Cardiovascular Diseases, Dr. Sharon Mulva. Dr. Mulva, good morning.
Well, good morning.
Thank you. Great day for a walk in the park, huh?
Absolutely. Well, can you hear the energy behind me here? They're just actually doing the mascot races, which are most entertaining, and that's going to be kicking off the walk that starts within the next hour after that.
Yeah, Dr. Shives and I were there last year for this, and so we know there are thousands of people that are there today. And what's happening with the Heart Walk? What else is in store?
Well, actually, you know, what has happened is that only the hardiest of the hardy Minnesotans are out here today. It's been a little unseasonal, as you know, the weather, but it's still quite a good turnout. And the last 2 hours, we have been educating and testing. We've had some cholesterol testing, blood pressure testing, and cardiovascular risk management education at the Mayo booth here. And there have been many other sponsors here with us that have been pulling all their efforts together to make this a very successful, despite Mother Nature's extra challenges today, event.
Well, the event, you know, it raises awareness. Like you said, you're even checking cholesterol levels there at the booth, but it raises money too. What do people need to know? What are you telling people about making their heart healthier?
Well, absolutely. Heart disease is really a lifestyle disease. We know that over 80% of heart disease is actually preventable by choosing the right lifestyle Wow, you can hear behind me. There's a lot of enthusiasm here. There's some definite favorites in the crowd for these mascots. But certainly making good choices in what we eat and being active and not smoking. Those are the key things in our choosing our heart-healthy lifestyle.
Is the message getting out there? I mean, as someone who works with people that need healthy hearts every day, is the message getting out there?
Absolutely. You know, Tracy, we have been keeping track of this, actually, and particularly in the way of increasing awareness of heart disease in women, which is also the number one killer of women. Not only just men die of heart disease, but both women and men. And because of the efforts of the national campaigns by the American Heart Association, by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, to increase the awareness, particularly in women, we have noted that in the last decade, the awareness has increased by over 100%. We've gone from 30% awareness. Now women know over 60% that they will die of heart disease and can do something about it. So it's very, very important. And the message is getting out there.
It's interesting, isn't it? Every year, more and more women recognize the fact that it's heart disease that's more likely to take their life than it is breast cancer.
That's absolutely right. One in three women will die of heart disease.
And so where is the best place to start? Is it to say, you know, I need to eat better, I need to, you know, snack less, or is it to say I need to be more active? You can't change your whole life all at once, but where should a person start?
You know, Tracy, that's a really good point, taking little steps and making small changes, but having an overall goal. So I think that, like you just said, it's a combination. I think we should be aware of what we put in our mouths and just have a little thought, you know, is this good for me? Is this good for my heart? And that will steer us away from those, you know, heavy, fat-laden calorie foods that, you know, we reserve for special treats instead of everyday things. And then just simple things in activity. Oh, I wish you could see what I'm seeing here. It's funny and a heart racing each other here and the gopher mascot. It's just so much fun. Anyway, the important thing is, like, take the stairs a little bit, you know, use one flight, you know, park your car a little further away. So just simple things to get started and say to yourself, you know, I am going to set a goal and I would like to be able to walk, you know, 20 minutes on most days of the week, you know, within the next couple of months and you'll get there. It's really important just to put it up on the top of your list of things to do today. I think it's that idea of just starting. If we make goals too high, then we'll never get there because it's daunting. But if we say simple things and we just say start today and don't look back, don't beat yourself up if you didn't do everything you wanted to do, but at least positive for what you did.
All right. And don't forget, if you smoke, that's the most important thing you could do. Oh, that should be on top of the list, right?
Absolutely, Tom. That is the number one thing. Do not smoke. Absolutely. And particularly for our young kids, you know, it's something that we have to really make sure that message is out there. That is the key. Don't smoke, eat right, and be active, and live a long, happy, heart-healthy life.
Perfect. Dr. Sharon Mulva from the American Heart Association Twin City Heart Walk, have a good day. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, and stay warm.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, we'll take a short break, but coming up, we'll talk with brain surgeon Dr. Michael Link and neuro-oncologist, brain tumor specialist Dr. Alex Porter, plus myth or matter of fact, cell phones can cause brain cancer. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for brain surgeon Dr. Michael Link and brain tumor specialist Dr. Alex Porter at 507-282-1234, or contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, and of course, tweet us anytime at #MayoRadio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae and this week's guest in studio, neurosurgeon Dr. Mike Link. Dr. Link, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
You like him already, don't you? You know why? He's an Iowa guy.
Oh, I should have known.
And also joining us by telephone from the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona, the director of neuro-oncology at Mayo Scottsdale and also the co-author of a relatively new book called Navigating Life with a Brain Tumor, Dr. Alex Porter. Dr. Porter, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you. Good to have you with us. Weather in Scottsdale okay? A little better than here, probably?
Indeed. Our high, though, is going to be 96 today, so I don't know about that.
Oh, you're suffering down there. I'm sorry to hear that.
Our foot of snow wishes we could have such warm temperatures.
Need that just at least for a day. So, Dr. Mike Link, your profession is operating on brain tumors and brain cancer. Explain the difference to us between a benign tumor and a malignant tumor and how, from your standpoint, that makes a difference.
From the surgical standpoint, we think of benign tumors as those tumors that we could completely remove with an operation, and that may be all the treatment that the patient needs. So that includes several different kinds of primary tumors, tumors that start within the head. We don't really think so much about cancer, brain tumors being cancer, because they almost never break off and show up elsewhere in the body like a lot of cancers can.
So brain cancers don't tend to metastasize or spread.
That's true. That's a rare event indeed. However, some types of brain tumors are very infiltrative or invasive, meaning they grab on to the brain and the other areas around the brain, and so we can't really cut them out and cure them. And so they require other treatment, and that's sort of what we consider to be malignant tumors.
So that then, Dr. Porter, is where your expertise might come into play, right?
That's right. And
go ahead and explain to us how you might become involved.
Yes, and so once a patient has been through their surgery, say with Dr. Link, and it's determined by the pathologist whether or not the tumor is benign or malignant, then we would talk about additional treatment options, which could include radiation or chemotherapy, sometimes a combination of both.
How do you tell when you look at it on an X-ray or a CAT scan or whatever it is that you get that picture of it? Which one is it usually, Dr. Porter? Is it a CAT scan?
It really depends. Typically, it's an MRI of the brain, usually given with contrast, and that tends to be the gold standard sort of neuroimaging that we prefer. Some patients, for whatever reason, either they have a pacemaker or they're too claustrophobic, for whatever reason, they can't have an MRI, and so then we need to use the CAT scan itself. But based on the imaging appearance of the tumor, whether or not it picks up contrast dye, where it's located, if it looks like it's along the surroundings of the brain or coming from within the brain architecture itself, those sorts of clues give us a sense of whether or not we're dealing with a benign or a malignant tumor.
Are you usually able to tell that right away just by the look of it, or has it ever been when you start off treating it as if it is malignant and find out that it's benign? Is it usually pretty cut and dry?
It's usually pretty straightforward, but MRI is only so good, and so there are several circumstances where we prefer to have the patient have a neurosurgical intervention first, either a biopsy or attempt at resection of the tumor to be 100% certain of what the diagnosis is.
Now, Dr. Link, when you go in to remove some of these tumors, or you're looking at the imaging trying to decide whether or not it can be removed, there are certain areas of the brain where you really can't operate, right? I mean, aren't there certain brain cancers that you just can't remove for whatever reason?
Yeah, certainly. And I would say MRI has really been a game changer for us from the surgical standpoint. Is almost all the time we have a very good idea before we go in there what we're going to find. And the advances in imaging have really helped us in that regard. But there are certainly areas of the brain that we don't want to violate or go into because we know it's going to give the patient devastating neurologic problem. So certain areas in the brain stem or deep in the deeper areas of the brain where motor function or speech or vision is processed, we really try and avoid those areas.
Dr. Porter, does a benign tumor show up in the front part of the brain and a malignant toward the back? Is there ever usually a regional part of the brain that you can tell if it's benign or malignant?
No, there's typically no rhyme or reason in terms of the location, but really the biggest difference is whether or not it looks like it's within the brain tissue itself or outside of the brain tissue but still within the skull. Sometimes that can be the biggest differentiating factor. So a meningioma per se, the majority of the times is a benign brain tumor, and that comes from the meninges, so it's just outside of the brain.
All right, now the meninges?
What correct. Those are the coverings of the brain.
Okay.
And so if you almost, if you picture the brain like a cauliflower, the meninges are that membrane, that clear membrane that's right over the top of the cauliflower. And the meningioma can then grow from that membrane.
Dr. Porter, what are some of the symptoms that bring patients into the doctor?
Yeah, it really depends on where the tumor is, and it can vary. Many tumors are found completely by accident. So a patient will have an MRI or a CAT scan for unrelated reasons. Maybe they had a slip and fall on the ice, or maybe they had a new or different headache, and they find that there is an abnormality there. Some patients, though, based on where their tumor is, can have changes in their personality, changes with their speech or language. They can experience weakness or numbness on either side of the body. They could have involuntary movements or altered levels of consciousness, spells that raise concern for seizures. So it really does range from symptoms that are quite obvious to no symptoms at all.
What about headaches? Is that a common presenting symptom or no?
Not necessarily a common presenting symptom, but it's the one that's most concerning for many patients. And the truth is, headaches are probably the most common symptom that patients go to any sort of doctor for. And brain tumors themselves and in the adult population are relatively rare. So patients shouldn't jump to the conclusion just because they've got a headache that they automatically have a brain tumor. But certainly, if you have a new or different headache, or if it's the worst headache of your life, certainly you should seek medical intervention or medical assessment so that some imaging can be done.
On the tumors that are picked up incidentally on a imaging study done for another reason, are most of those benign, or do you see some malignant ones also?
On occasion, we see some malignant ones. Usually they're benign.
And so it sounds like if these tumors are operable, no matter whether they're benign or malignant, that's your preferred first line of defense. So that Dr. Link would take this tumor out, benign or malignant. If it was benign, that would be the end of the story, hopefully. If it was malignant, then there would be some additional treatment in after the surgery, correct?
That's right. And as Dr. Link mentioned before, it really depends on the location, because even for some benign tumors, if they occur up along the brain stem, the risk of the surgery may be worse than the tumor just being there. And so just because we suspect it's benign, we don't always recommend that it be excised. But yes, if we have a malignant tumor, and let's say it occurs in the right frontal lobe, away from the area of the brain that controls motor function or sensory function on the left side of the body, absolutely. That would be a circumstance where we would say, yes, let's try to take out this tumor in its entirety.
Dr. Link, what has changed in surgery and brain surgery? How long have you been practicing? How many years?
23 years now.
Okay, so what has changed over those 20 or so years in that we know about? Because it's kind of the final frontier, almost. I mean, once you get in there, then you discover what you really have to work with or what the situation is. What has changed?
So I think certainly the technology has advanced greatly, not only in the imaging that I mentioned, which really helps us significantly in sort of knowing what to expect when we get in there, but also things like image guidance. So now we can basically register an outline of the patient's head in a computer before we operate, and then have those images displayed in the operating room. And that computer can kind of guide us, give us a path to where we're going to go. So we can biopsy deep areas of the brain very safely. We can sort of chart a path that we think is the safest way to get to the tumor. We now actually have an intraoperative MRI, so we can take a tumor out, put the patient in the MRI scanner while the head is still open and they're still anesthetized, do an immediate MRI scan and find out, did we get it all or not? And if not, proceed with more surgery without having to wake the patient up, do another scan, and so on. So I think things like that. Also, I think just the instrumentation has gotten better over the years. The microscopes have gotten better optics. The anesthesia techniques have gotten better. We now do some brain tumor operations with the patient actually awake. So
you're laughing.
No, well, it's because it sounds like a mad scientist type of a thing. But I know they do the same thing for like Parkinson's disease, and that
absolutely,
there's some of those things that it's beneficial to have the patient awake.
One of the sort of neat tricks, you might say, in the brain is it has no pain fibers itself. So the bone and the skin and the covering of the brain, if we anesthetize that with local anesthesia, we can actually operate in the in the brain, and it's not painful at all for the patient.
Myth or matter of fact.
Yeah, before we take our break, we do have to go to our myth or matter of fact, because there is a discussion going on Facebook that we can't get a consensus. So myth or matter of fact, and we'll ask both of you this. We'll start Dr. Link. Do cell phones cause brain cancer? Myth or matter of fact, Dr. Link?
That is a fascinating question that has been debated both in the lay press and in the medical literature, mm-hmm. I will say, for a couple of decades. And I can say with a lot of confidence, the answer is we don't know. And I can say that after there have been more than $10 million of research thrown at this very question. So there was a great big study called the Interphone Study. It involved 13 countries trying to answer this question. And there's lots of reasons why we can't answer the question. But the bottom line is that nobody really knows.
I think we need a second opinion. Dr. Porter?
Dr. Porter, what do you think?
How about you weigh in on this?
Do you have hands free or do you use your cell phone?
I use my cell phone. And, you know, I understand why it's so controversial. And I understand why people want to believe that it's true and why so much money has been pouring into this question. We really all have the desire to figure out what causes cancer and what did I do to get this tumor or what could I have done to prevent this. And so a cell phone is a good place to start to try to look into those things. But at this point in time, it really seems to be just a myth. You know, same thing with standing in front of a microwave or something like that. And so there are a few things that we know can contribute to developing brain cancer. One is prior exposure to radiation. Another is if you have an underlying genetic syndrome, a syndrome that runs in your family that makes you prone towards cancers. So short of those things, we really don't know what causes brain tumors.
All right, but we don't think cell phones do it, but we don't know for sure. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio with neurosurgeon Dr. Mike Link and neurologist Dr. Alex Porter from Scottsdale. Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. Right after that, your phone calls and your comments and questions from our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, and your tweets at #MayoRadio.
This is Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with a look at health and medical news. A drink from the fountain of youth. It's been a quest of many for centuries to find a way to stop disease and extend life. Well, researchers at Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University may have unlocked some secrets. They may have found the body's fountain of aging, the brain region known as the hypothalamus. They say this area of the brain in mice controls aging, and their discovery of a specific age-related signaling pathway could lead to new strategies for fighting diseases of old age and extending lifespan. They say what's exciting is that it's possible, at least in mice, to alter signaling to slow down the aging process and increase longevity. This was published in the journal Nature. Now, Alzheimer's disease is considered a disease of aging, and Mayo Clinic researchers have found that elderly patients who receive anesthesia are no more likely to develop long-term dementia or Alzheimer's disease than other seniors. Here's Dr. David Warner.
The overall results of this study are good news, that there's, again, lots of things to be concerned about, but it doesn't look like you have to be concerned that just having a surgical procedure will necessarily put you at risk for developing dementia or Alzheimer's disease later in your life.
The findings are published in the journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings. And here's some more about anesthesia. Spinal or epidural anesthesia improves outcomes in patients having hip or knee replacements. That's according to a new study by researchers at Hospital for Special Surgery. The study shows this type of regional anesthesia reduces morbidity, mortality, length of hospital stay, and costs when compared with general anesthesia. Study authors say their research suggests that the type of anesthesia used may have important impacts on all kinds of medical and economic outcomes in orthopedic surgery. The study authors say regional anesthesia should be considered for these surgeries. And in other news, some information about what some college kids are doing to cram for exams. A growing number are abusing the ADHD drug Adderall to get an academic edge, and they're tweeting about it. Thanks to Twitter, which tracks tweets, they were able to publish the data in the Journal of Medical Internet Research. The researchers found two major things. Adderall is mentioned most heavily among students in the Northeast and South regions of the U.S. Tweets peak during final exam periods. They hope the study renews interest in promoting the safe and legal use of Adderall and other substances on college campuses, and they want to promote student well-being and study habits to better manage the academic demands and pressures of college. And that's a look at health and medical news. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Information you want from specialists who know. In just a moment, you can join the conversation by calling us at 507-282-1234 or tweeting us at hashtag Mayo Radio. As we've been learning, a brain tumor diagnosis can mean quite a few different things depending on the type of tumor that a patient has. However, that initial diagnosis is never easy. Joining us now is a friend to both Dr. Shives and myself, Jen O'Hara. Jen's daughter, Shannon, was diagnosed with brain cancer back in April of 2011. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning. Good to be here.
It is good to have you here, Jen, and I know this is never going to be easy, but take us back to the start of this whole ordeal. How did you find out? When were you first told that Shannon had brain cancer?
Oh, I can remember the day vividly, April 15th of 2011, and it was really after just a week of searching into what was going on. Shannon had complained about a headache and actually a sort of a unique headache in that she felt like her eyes were having trouble tracking. So we saw our family med doctor, and he said we should get her eyes checked. The next day we saw our optometrist, and her vision was 20/20, but the optometrist actually detected a little bounce in her eyes as they tracked, and he suggested we see a neurologist. So 2 days later, we were at neurology at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and still not concerned, but wanted us to have an MRI. And the next day, Friday, April 15th, as Dr. Porter said, that MRI imaging revealed the tumor. And Shannon's type of tumor was a brainstem glioma known as a DIPG, and inoperable and incurable.
And they knew that on the basis of the MRI scan, correct?
They were fairly certain. I mean, you can never say 100% certainty, but the imaging is good enough, and that type of tumor presents itself in a way that they were fairly certain that's what they were dealing with. We did have a surgical consult. I mean, as they do, they check all your options, and we saw a surgeon to review those options if there was any sort of surgical option, but he was fairly certain that surgery was not a course we could take.
Where was the tumor located in her head?
So it was within the brainstem. So okay. A brainstem glioma, and that's the reason that, the collateral damage of operating on a brainstem is worse than trying to treat it. She would have had such a loss of function trying to surgically remove it that we had to look at other courses of treatment.
And what were those other, what did you do for her treatment?
So 5 days after the diagnosis, we were back at Mayo Clinic Rochester starting a chemo and radiation 6-week course of those 5 days a week on the radiation and every day, 7 days a week on the chemotherapy.
So what was the most difficult part of this whole thing? I think it was only 9 months between the diagnosis and when Shannon lost her life. And when did you realize that this was probably going to take her life?
Well, I asked the question April 15th of actually the neurologist that was called in, and I said, what is the life expectancy of someone with this tumor? So we were told the day of diagnosis that people don't survive with a brainstem glioma, but how long? Again, you can never be sure. When did I really believe that Shannon was going to lose her life? When it recurred in November of 2011, when the tumor recurred, and then, you can't re-radiate the same area, so we were without great options at that point for treatment.
So what sort of impact did this whole ordeal have on your family?
Oh, it's shock and disbelief and trying to get your ducks in a row to figure out, what do you do when you find out that your child has a brain tumor and that, you do your best to treat it and to let her live the life that she had left to live, and Shannon really was sort of the driving force. I mean, as a mother, I probably wanted to curl up in a ball from April 15th on and shut out the world, but that wasn't Shannon's choice.
And for the listeners who didn't know, Shannon was one of those remarkable children who had I don't know where it came from, the grace and the courage that she had to do what she did in those months of her life that were remaining. But she's been gone for over a year now. And what has happened in that year?
Well, we as a family, and my husband Dan and our other daughter Erin, were certainly inspired by Shannon to try to carry on and do some good in her memory and make something good happen from this. And we've started a foundation, the Shannon O'Hara Foundation, and our goals really are to help local youth here in Rochester and also to support brain tumor research. That was, even at 12 years old when she was diagnosed, Shannon knew she wanted to try to make a difference.
And part of her, which this is my favorite part of the story, part of her actually lives on. Her tumor is still alive. Explain
yes.
that part to me, because I'm just a junkie for the research angle of everything. So tell me that part.
Well, one of the issues with brainstem gliomas is because they can't be surgically removed, it is hard to study them. I mean, it is hard to know exactly what's going on in that tumor type. So it was important to us and to Shannon that her tumor could be used in the research. And at the end of our treatment, when Shannon's tumor did recur, we ended up going to St. Jude in Memphis, Tennessee, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital.
There was a study there that she qualified for.
Yes, actually, the Mayo Clinic in Rochester helped us research clinical trial options, and we chose to go to St. Jude. That was an experimental chemotherapy drug they were trying there on this type of tumor. And as part of that research, we were given the option, when Shannon did pass, to donate the tumor. So Shannon passed away on Friday, January 6th of 2012, and by noon, January 7th, her tumor was in Memphis, Tennessee, with the help of Mayo Clinic pathology and getting the tumor there that quickly so that it could be in lab, and it continues to grow there now.
Continue to be studied. Dr. Porter, what does that, having that living tumor, mean for research?
Well, it's so important because diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma, or DIPG, also known as brainstem glioma, is one of the fewest studied forms of brain cancer, just for the reasons that have already been outlined. Because it's in such a critical territory, we're not able to resect that tumor, so not much is known. And then the other thing about it is this is a common... It's even though it's rare, it's more commonly occurring in children. And so it's so difficult to put children through that risk of any sort of surgery. And so by this family's generosity, we have the opportunity to learn so much more about this tumor type and to really be able to hopefully one day use personalized medicine and really tailor particular chemotherapeutic options for this particular tumor rather than using the same sort of chemotherapy that we give to just about all malignant gliomas.
So as you were just saying today, Jen, that as her tumor continues to grow, a part of it was brought back to Mayo because there's some researchers here that are studying it as well.
Yes, so the tumor at St. Jude, they continue to grow it, and they take sections of it and freeze it for use. They're trying 200,000 different compounds on the tumor at St. Jude to see what sort of hits they get that have anti-cancer activity. If any of those show promise, they'll then take it into mice. If that showed promise, they'd go to a drug company and write a protocol to try to use it in humans. Here at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, researchers are working on some vaccines, and so they're looking to use these tumor cells to try to develop those vaccines as well.
We're going to run out of time if we don't give you at least 90 seconds to give us a commercial. Tell us about, so what has also changed in the year is the blog that you use to keep everybody updated has taken on a life of its own as well.
Yes, it has. We've the blog that my husband and I wrote throughout Shannon's journey, we have turned into a book titled Determined to Matter, which is almost a direct quote from Shannon. And really, it's just one family's journey with brain cancer with a brain tumor, how we chose to live our life in that time that Shannon had left, and our goal of trying to make a difference going forward. So
The highs and the lows.
It's all real.
And it's going to be available for sale within the next month, and you can already pre-order it at Amazon.
Correct. The publication date is June 1st, but it's out there on Amazon and at your local retailers to pre-order right now.
And Dr. Porter, you have written a book as well.
That's right. Our book, along with myself and Dr. Lynn Taylor, who's at Tufts University Medical Center, wrote a book called Navigating Life with a Brain Tumor. And this is really a resource for patients and their family members to help demystify the idea of brain tumors and to help make sense of some of the complicated language that we use, and really to help empower patients to teach them different things that they can do to help in their journey and to help make things a little bit more smooth. And so it's not necessarily the type of book that we wanted patients to read from cover to cover, but certainly through looking at the table of contents, they can pick out those parts that might be pertinent to them and of most use.
Jen O'Hara, we know Shannon was special to you and to a lot of other people, and we really appreciate you being here to share your story, and we share your loss with you, and we're very sorry for that. But it's great to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me today.
You know, you just sit tight, because I have a question for that we haven't even got to yet for Dr. Link. What is in the future? We started talking about how it has changed in 20 years, but can you explain what a gamma knife is?
Sure. Yes. So that's one of the technologies that has certainly advanced in the last 20 years. And a gamma knife is actually not a knife at all. It's just a way to deliver very focused radiation. And it can be used for either benign or malignant tumors, but it very much focuses the radiation in a specific area and limits the amount of radiation to the surrounding brain. And all that radiation can be delivered in one day instead of spread out over 5 to 6 weeks.
So it's more like a laser than a scalpel?
Well, it's not really a laser. It is radiation.
Okay.
But it's given in a manner that it becomes very focused. Actually, what it is it's 192 different radiation sources that are all aimed to meet at the same point. Hmm. And what we do is we put the patient's tumor at that point. So each individual beam has very little effect, but where all 192 intersect has a lot of effect.
So compare and contrast that with a proton beam, which is where we are going here at Mayo. I mean, there's a few of these around the country. Mayo is just putting, well, not quite the finishing touches, but we're building one here too. What is a proton
here
beam?
Here and in Scottsdale,
yes,
Arizona.
Yes, Scottsdale too, sure.
That's right. So proton beam actually uses protons, which are heavy particles, to deliver radiation. And they have a unique advantage in the sense that protons travel through space and then give all their energy off in one short distance, so that there's a little bit of dose going in, there's a lot of dose where that particle gives off its energy at the tumor, and then there's basically no exit dose. And that has a significant advantage for certain tumors that are near critical structures. Certain things like some tumors at the base of the skull near the brain stem would have some real advantages for that technology. It's not going to be for all types of brain tumors. For instance, the diffuse brainstem glioma wouldn't be a good candidate for protons, but certain kinds of tumors, both in the brain and elsewhere in the body, are going to be advantaged by protons.
Dr. Porter, doesn't that proton beam, won't that work well for children? Because part of the problem with children getting radiation is that their brain is still growing. Isn't that correct?
That's right. And so what we're able to do with the proton beam is really carve out the region that you want to receive radiation and avoid the fallout side effects of additional radiation being spilled over into additional structures. So yes, it's very instrumental in the pediatric population, particularly if radiation has to be given to the brain and the spinal cord. Now, the way we're giving radiation, there's some spillover that can go into even the abdominal structures and abdominal organs, but with the proton beam, you can really limit the radiation to the spinal canal itself. So it's something that we're excited about and really looking forward to implementing in the future here.
Let's talk a little bit about prognosis. The O'Haras were told when Shannon was diagnosed that her life expectancy was probably about 9 months. Isn't that right, Jen? And they were right on, despite radiation, despite chemotherapy. But in general, what are the statistics with regard to prognosis for, first of all, someone with a benign brain tumor, Dr. Link?
Well, for most benign brain tumors like the meningioma, for instance, that Dr. Porter mentioned, or acoustic neuroma is another type of benign brain tumor that we see, the prognosis should really be excellent. And by that, I mean good neurologic function and shouldn't take a day off a person's lifespan.
All right. And then, Dr. Porter, the malignant varieties, and I know there are a lot of different kinds, and it depends on the grade of the tumor and what kind it is and where it's located. But overall, the prognosis for people who have brain cancer.
Right. So the most common malignant brain tumor is glioblastoma multiforme. That's a grade 4 of 4 astrocytoma. That's the Ted Kennedy tumor, for example. And so this tumor is difficult. Without treatment, the prognosis can be several weeks to months. With our best treatment available, which is a combination of chemotherapy, radiation, the median survival is around 14 to 15 months. Some patients are doing much better than that. Some patients less than that. It really depends on whether or not, number one, they can have the tumor taken out in its entirety. Number two, whether or not they're left with any neurologic deficit as a result of the tumor itself or even the surgery. And then number three, how well they do getting through our treatments, the chemotherapy and the radiation.
So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I think that now we've got several genetic studies that we can do on the tumors, and that can also give us some sense of prognosis and whether or not certain patients' tumors are more likely to respond to chemotherapy. So that can be helpful information as well.
It is Brain Tumor Awareness Month, Dr. Porter, and that's why we are doing this program. And as we're winding down here, I want to make sure to give both you and Dr. Link, what do you want people to know about brain tumor? What awareness would you like to give?
I think the most important thing is that I want patients to have some sense of hope. They're through the imaging techniques, through clinical trials and new drugs being investigated, and really streamlined radiation efforts. We have some improved treatment options, more so than we ever have before. And so I think the future is better than the past has been for brain cancer, and I'm hoping that through this program, patients will find themselves and people would find themselves a bit more educated, and hopefully find that there are some resources that are available and treatments that are available for these sorts of tumors.
Dr. Link, you've indicated that your techniques are much better than they used to be. What's your hope for the future with regard to these patients who have brain cancer?
I think ideally the real long-term hope is that my job is going to become obsolete, that we're going to be able to find drug therapy and radiation therapy that's going to make invasive surgery less and less a role in the treatment. And I would just echo what Dr. Porter said, that I think there's a lot of reason to be hopeful for patients who have brain tumors. If you just take the most malignant type of brain tumor that Dr. Porter mentioned, when I started practice, the average survival was less than a year. I think now it's up over 18 months, so we're making progress.
Dr. Michael Link, thanks so much for being with us.
Dr. Porter, thank you for joining us as well. And Jen O'Hara, your book, Determined to Matter, about your daughter, Shannon, is going to be available at Amazon. You can go there right now. You can go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, for information about both Jen and Dr. Porter's books.
You're listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio, we'll talk about shared decision-making with Dr. Victor Montori. You know, believe it or not, Tracy, it's time, everybody thinks that it's time, for patients to actually participate in decisions that affect their own care.
Well, certainly even just to advocate for themselves even a little bit more. You don't have to just say, whatever you say, doc, you know, whatever's best.
Yep. Well, it's not happening anymore, at least in some places. And, you know, that's probably a good thing. The doctor and the patient should talk about all the various treatment options, and together they should decide what's best for that particular patient, that particular individual. It's called patient-centered decision. decision-making. And it's a concept that emphasizes respect and the right of the patient to actually decide what's going to happen to them. So I think it's probably very good.
If I've ever met a passionate guest, it was the last time we had Dr. Victor Muntori on to talk about this, and he's going to be back to discuss shared decision-making with us once again.
That's right, and we're going to tell you exactly how you go about getting more involved in your own medical care. You know, let's talk about this, Doctor. Shared decision-making next week on Medical Edge Radio. We hope you'll join us.
For more information on topics discussed on this program, visit our website at radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can also access a podcast of today's program and previous shows, or you can visit us at mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers share their expertise to help you manage your health.
You've been listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Kim David. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.